Commission on Aging, June 20th.
The county councilor is elected.
Yes.
Yeah, he spoke to us.
They're elected. Four-year terms.
Hey.
I was like, is mine backwards?
She needed the extra help.
I guess she needed a reminder. I don't know. This is critical.
The June 20th meeting of the Commission on Aging will please come to order. May I have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The agenda is approved. May I have a motion for the approval of the minutes dated May 16th, 2017?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Those who are opposed?
Abstain.
The motion is carried. The minutes are approved. This evening we have two new members with us, and at this time I will say a few words about them to embarrass them or to keep them from having to say words about themselves. Amy Gross, over here. Now retired, Amy has a strong background and interest in older adults, including direct service experience in county and private nonprofit agencies. She has held a number of positions that include postgraduate training as a geropsychologist, setting up and supervising and working an older adult partial hospitalization program, running an older adult counseling center in a community health center, serving on the board and two committees of the Los Angeles Alzheimer's Association, and running several Alzheimer caregiver support groups. Amy earned a PhD in clinical psychology from Alliant International University, and her published dissertation was The Effects of Age and Intelligence on Personality Traits of Older Adults. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
Temple Lentz. Temple is the business director for the Heather DeFord Group of Cascade Sotheby's International Realty and an owner principal of High Five Media, a marketing firm and producer of Hello Vancouver, a lively talk show that Temple hosts. Previously, she served as the executive director of the Parks Foundation of Clark County, leading a record increase in corporate and foundation giving and successfully writing and obtaining a large grant from Murdoch Trust. She also has been a campaign director for a winning candidate and actively involved in public service that includes advisory boards for the Friends of the Columbia Gorge, KXRW Radio, Arts of Clark County, and Leadership Clark County. Welcome, Temple. Let us applaud. Moving to reports, is there a report from the Public Health Advisory Committee?
No report this month.
The Area Agency on Aging and Disabilities of Southwest Washington, Linda?
Yes, I'm making this report on behalf of Pat Janik. And this meeting was held, the Advisory Council meeting was held on May 17th, and they reviewed current work by state legislature on budget and priorities important to the work of ADSWA. Several members reported on the Aging in Rural Oregon Conference this past month, which included some innovative programs that could be duplicated in other areas. Two employees of ADSWA Information and Assistance Program presented scenarios of calls to the department and explained how they were able to help people obtain necessary resources. And the council meeting was brief so that all could attend the first Senior Heroes Luncheon. I also would like to report on the Area Aging on Aging and Disabilities Resource Network, which I attend, and it was a very exciting and productive meeting. We heard from Dr. Corey Balkin from WSUV on the outcome study of Southwest Washington Aging in Place Needs Assessment. We heard from Eric Lawrence from Clark County Fire and Rescue on the community paramedicine and technologies options to improve access to care, which is a lot of words, but it's an exciting program that is where paramedics who go to homes all the time for older adults that fall or whatever, but they would up their ante and provide other services. And so it's exciting that they could do home safety studies or maybe see if they what their resources are and help them. So that's it's an exciting program. We also broke up into groups and we're looking at advocacy, access to care, transportation and housing, and community planning, and setting some goals for ourselves as a group. And that is my report.
Thank you.
You.
This year's focus is on supportive services, as all of you know. This is our fourth installment, and this evening we have two speakers, which we've not done before. So you're going to have to split the time, but I think they look pretty friendly with each other, so it shouldn't be a problem. The purpose of our focus on supportive services is to identify and highlight existing services in Clark County and shed light on those that may need to exist in the future. At the end of the year, we will be making a culminating report to Clark County Council, as we did last year, on housing. Our major purpose is to raise awareness, advocate, and work for all those 65 and over in this community who we know, as they get older, will need special help, especially for those who want to age in their own home, which we know is 90% of those people. While our primary focus is on supportive services this year, we have not abandoned housing. As you know, we made recommendations last year, and we continue to darken the doorway of the County Council, waiting for their word on how they're going to implement those recommendations, but we know they're working hard on them. Our first speaker this evening is Clara Chambers. Clara, a clinical pharmacist, will discuss medication management, including issues related to taking multiple prescriptions, including herbal and dietary supplements. She has been a pharmacist since 1994, serving most of her career with the Veterans Administration in primary care, research pharmacy, and on an inpatient and outpatient basis. Welcome, Clara.
Thank you. I just want to thank you for inviting me to speak about this. It's kind of near and dear to my heart. I work with a group of practitioners, nurses that go out into the home. And this is something we encounter every single week with patients. It's a challenge. We're always having to come up with innovative ways to help people manage their medications, or we actually have staff that prepare medicines and such to help them. So basically, I'm talking about the challenge of managing the ever-changing medication regimes that we've given. I mean, you go to a doctor, you get something, and then you go to somebody else, and you get something, and you see something you want on the TV, and you get something else. So it's always a challenge. But the most basic thing...
Can you pull the microphone just a little closer to you, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
The most... You think it's a bit basic, but... And you think, oh, the doctor knows exactly what I want. I would always advise everybody to make a list of all your medications. So just in case you have to go to an ED, an ER, maybe you're traveling, they have that. And it's so important to write what you're taking and be honest about how frequently you're taking. It's amazing how many patients tell their doctors, yeah, I'm taking this and this and that, and they're tweaking the meds. And in reality, we go out there and we find out they're not taking it at all. So please go ahead and put how much you're taking it. It's nice to know when you're taking it. So if they want to add another med to you, okay, how many are you taking at this time? A lot of people are really great if they take all their meds at one time in the morning, but you start adding noontime and lunch and dinners, and it's really hard because it's not part of their routine, or if you only have to take one med at that time, it's a challenge. And the other thing that I always love is that if somebody will tell me, you know, I had a reaction to that. Some of them were really, you had a rash, that's pretty apparent. Or did it make you feel kind of wonky? Did it just made me out of it? I just couldn't deal with it. Or I had diarrhea, or I was horrendously constipated. All those things, if that makes you not want to take that med, share that with your provider, because there's so much out there. You could probably come up with a different medication. I mean, there's a fair bit out. The other thing that's really help people, and some of them, the nurses actually set them up. They're called MediSets. I have one just like Bloomer over there. It helps me. I'm taking once a day, but I don't think I take them. So this lets me know, yeah, you did take it or no, you didn't take it, because they'll still be in there if I didn't. We've had a few people that need to talk to them. They need a little bit more of a prompt. They're cognitively, they just need that, they're not going to remember. We've had people use their cell phones as a way to set alarms to help them remember. There's some that we set up that's for, you know, multiple times of the day, a.m., afternoon, p.m., or bedtime, and it'll set an alarm, and it's already in the machine. You'll see that in the right-hand corner. And then I just included this fancy schmancy one, kind of as an example. There's actually companies. I think High School Pharmacy still does it, but there's a few other. If you want to pay them, they will set up various things where you just punch out and the whole, all your meds come out of it. And they're little cards, and they'll have like little pockets, and they'll put multiple meds in it. And you just punch it, and you've got all your meds for your AM, and you don't ever have to set it up. It is a small fee, but it's a viable option. But the caveat there is you have to make sure you're kind of consistently on that same dose. For things like some of the blood thinners where they're always tweaking and adjusting the dose, that's just not the best option there. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is the over-the-counter meds. And this is basically anything that you can purchase without a prescription. Some of them used to be prescription meds, now you can get them. And I put a few of them that I really wanted to touch base with are the cough and cold products. From my perspective as a pharmacist, sometimes those things interfere with what you're being prescribed. Or they can make some things worse. If you were kind of have a little bit of confusion, you can take something, let's say like Benadryl, or, and that's it, just about every sleep med or cough medicine, it can make you more confused. It can make some people, let's say if you have some sort of respiratory thing, your mucus can get really thick, it's harder to clear, it can make you more dizzy, so you can fall. So some of these things, while they sound great and they're nice and easy to find in the stores, there could be some consequences with taking them. The same with pain relievers. Let's say like the Aleve of the world or ibuprofen or Motrin. Some of those sound really great. However, they can interfere with a lot of your prescription meds. So what I wanted to kind of ask you is, or recommend, I should say, is always go and ask the pharmacist. And if you have that lovely list of medications, you can say, this is what I want, just in case, yeah, that's maybe not the pharmacist you typically go to. But they can sit there and answer and go, okay, this could be an issue here, and this could be an issue with this one, just so you know. And plus, they can look at some meds, like if you're on medications to help you be able to go for lack of a better term, urinate there. Some of those will make you retain urine, so it's going to make things worse when you're trying to treat and make things better. So they'll be able to give you that kind of an insight. Kind of went ahead of myself there. And there is quite a few of those, I'll be honest. Because every week I'm sitting here looking at patients' medication regimes, and there's quite a bit that I'm making comments to providers about over-the-counter usage. At the VA, that's where I work. That just, it can be prescribed. So I have the luxury of usually seeing that on their medication list so I know it's there. So I can make recommendations and just say, you know, this could make this medication a little less effective. Because let's say, again, with the Motrins and the Aleves of the world, it can make some of your blood pressure medicines less effective. If some people don't stay hydrated in this time of year, some people are just not really great, or some people who, as they get older, they just don't drink enough fluids, so it can cause some issues. So it's always these little things that need to be considered, and maybe if you could share it with the pharmacist or your provider, if they're recommending it, is this going to be okay with this and that, that can maybe lead you down the path of not having at least an area of issues with a medication. This one I have to laugh a little bit. Coming into herbal and food supplements, we just had a new patient today, and he had like 13 different herbals that he was taking, and quite a few of them had like 10 or 15 different products in that herbal. And I'm looking at his meds, and going, you know, there's a wonderful website, it's called, I can get it to you through the council here. Natural Medicines, there we go, website. And it helps you to see if it's been an issue with some of the medications. They keep it updated. There's a staff. They look to see, is it really been, looking at all the studies, has it been proven to be effective, where it might have some possible benefits, any kind of reported side effects to it. So that's the place if you're thinking about it, and it isn't paid by a company, so it's not biased in any way. It's just their reporting of what's out there in the literature. And, you know, I'm all for it. I take herbals and I take some food supplements. It's just I have to look at what I'm taking and is it going to be okay with what I've really got on board. And you'll hear the supplements, and I just wanted to kind of point out, sometimes they'll say minerals. And so basically that's like magnesium. Sometimes people will call iron or a mineral, you know. So that's what they mean by that. Then you have multivitamins, and we all know what those are, one a day, and they have a host of vitamins in them. And then you get into the coenzyme Q, and you've got the fish oils and the glucose being those supplements. And that's another nice thing about that website I gave you, the Natural Medicine. They kind of give you an idea when you're reading about it, how soon are you going to see those benefits? If you're going to take it, by golly, the least it can do is work for you. Unfortunately, it's not going to be like, let's say, a pain medicine, you know, like a Vicodin or something. It's not going to work immediately. Like glucosamine, it can take up to a month before you see benefit of it. So you have to just kind of be persistent and stay with it, but it's worth it if you get the benefits from it. Another thing people don't really think about, but a lot of these juices kind of fall into that supplement. A lot of interactions with pomegranate juice and grapefruit juice is a huge one. So ask if that's going to be okay. Definitely the grapefruit juice. It can make some of your medications, they just don't clear your system as fast as one would expect. And so maybe the doses need to be lower on those kind of medications if somebody's been drinking grapefruit juice, but talking about usually it's, you know, quite a bit of grapefruit juice, you know, definitely like over 8 ounces a day of grapefruit juice, but some people definitely like the grapefruit, so it's something to think about. And that's another thing to ask your pharmacist, is this going to interfere with what I have already taking? Just kind of a little hint on some of like, let's say melatonin, that's gotten a lot of press lately, and it's to help people with their sleep and help reset your sleep cycles. And it does have some potential interactions, but it's nothing that's not manageable. Let's say if you're taking aspirin daily, it can make you just may have a little bit more risk of bleeding or bruising. But you can always just apply pressure. It's not anything huge. I mean, those things are measured in seconds. But it's something to think about. And it, just to give the medication sometimes can impact that. So again, a good question to ask. But one thing I will say, if you can ever, if it's possible, try to get something you see this USB. The reason I suggest that is they've actually gone into these places where these are manufactured. They're clean, there's been minimal contamination at all. They've proven through tests that what it says on the bottle is exactly what's in there, and to be the amount is in there. That's the problem with this industry, I have to say, is there's no lot, there isn't any real oversight. And some people, they've done a lot of tests, and some of it has nothing in it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's not a cheap option. It's a rather typically rather spending. When I looked at the USP website just this week, just to name a few, there's a couple of three big companies that have asked them to come in and look at their sites. And that's Nature's Made. They make a lot of vitamins and some supplements. The Kirkland Signature, and, you know, some of Dr. Lambert, that's that, but it's in one of the markets. And then some True Nature. I have to say, I've not seen that brand. But if you can, stay with those. They make sure, like I said, they're safe, they're sanitary, and they get manufactured in a well-controlled manufacturing plant. If, however, that's not possible, all I would recommend is if you find something that works for you, stay with that brand. Because there usually isn't a lot of variation within a brand, but there could be variations within other brands. Like sometimes people don't like it. It worked really well and then it stopped, but take a look and see if maybe you change the manufacturer you bought it from. And a lot of companies, let's say if you have a natural grocery or something, they've done some research on who's selling their products and there's this one. So.
Things last longer like bread, you know, other products you can put in there to help for it.
Medication sometimes plays a role in how long a medication is going to be effective, because sometimes it will make them kind of like disintegrate. So I ask that you not put stuff, recommend not putting things like above the stove, where maybe you're cooking and steam will go up, or we've had people put stuff in the bathroom. It doesn't really work very well that way. We don't ask that you do that. The other thing is, there's one other thing I wanted to make sure I said. I said it at some point in our report. I recommend that you not keep it. Oh, sometimes, definitely in the car, especially when it's hot like this, and when you go in a cold environment, that can really impact your medications and how long they're going to be effective for you. So I really would not recommend putting things in the air in your car. Another thing I would recommend when people store, a lot of our patients like to keep the same bottle. And whenever something new comes in, they just pour it in the same old one. And then you don't have the right prescription number to reorder it with. And then you really don't know when that prescription was mailed out to them. So I would advise not doing that. We have the lovelies who just pour everything in a bowl. And we have Mishmash and Meds, and the nurse went out there to try to do something, change their bed, and they're like, well, here's the bowl. It's like, and they expected the person to be able to know exactly what that prescription looks like and to pick it out of the bowl amongst multiple other medications. So just when you think you've seen everything, some people can surprise you, so I would not advise doing that. And I've also had some problems if it's the same medication, but maybe a different dose. We've had people pour those in the bottles. So if you know somebody, really recommend they not do that. You know, keep everything in its original bottle, if at all possible. And one thing I forgot to mention when we talked about Medisets, there are some medications that cannot be taken out of those containers. There's a specific blood thinner that we have that cannot be out of the original container. So we, if somebody's not, I don't know if y'all are with Coumadin or Warfarin, if we're trying to move them from that to something else where they don't require all those blood tests, we have to pick the right one. Because if we have to do Medisets, then there's a couple that we can't use. So if you're going to be using a Mediset, please let your provider know that too, and let the pharmacist know that. And they'll know, okay, that can't come out of the original bottle, so this isn't going to work. And let them call back to your provider and get some changes. Because I think Medisets are great, I use them all the time, and so just kind of relaying that information helps everybody to stay on the same page. Another question we get quite a bit is, what do I do with the old meds? You know, recommend that definitely get you separated out, because we've had multiple errors by various patients thinking they were taking the right dose. One medication that they had in bottles, two different bottles with two different doses of the same med, and they were taking the wrong medication. So please separate them out. I would say put them in a baggie, or if you have the ability to put them in a different room so there is just absolutely no way, no how you can get them mixed up, I would advise that. And the best of all things are if you feel that you can let go ahead and get rid of them. There's various options. Sometimes you'll see an advertised drug take-back day. I always take advantage of those if you could. There's some programs. Unfortunately, you can buy it. It's an envelope. But you mail it in, and they will take that envelope and then burn it in the incinerator like they would do any medications. They're not going to look at your name. They're not going to do any of that kind of stuff. And then some of the actual law enforcement offices have electronic boxes. And those, if you have, or families that have, that are comics types, they will take them back. Some places won't take those back because they don't want anything to do with those kind of medications. They don't want them. Pharmacies don't take these things back to do that kind of a program. I think there's just some proposals, but it's not there yet because it is expensive because they have to return before it's destroyed. So that would be my big recommendation there. And with that, I would like you to ask me some questions, or if you have some instances, go ahead.
I just have something to add that the transfer station, the dump, when you take back your pain or your spray cans, they will also take your prescription medications.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And I've actually, for a friend to even insulin syringes out there, they'll take, because that's another other way to try to get rid of some of that stuff, because I'm all tied up. Yeah.
Okay. I'll ask commission members if they have questions, and then we'll go to the audience. Linda?
Yeah, I have a question. It sounds like you do quite a bit of work within the Clark County area, or the nurses have a presence in the area? If you could make one recommendation of something that you would change in terms of the aging and medications, or a suggestion, what might that be?
What I have to say is because the nurses go into the home, it's an eye-opener. You really get an idea of what's really going on in the situation. Providers will have a tendency to just prescribe stuff and they assume people are on it. You get the real information because if it's ever possible for somebody to be able to go in the home. The next best thing is if people with those brown bags, if they could really truly bring everything. I think there's some programs that I know a lot of the pharmacy students try to get involved in. I don't know about Washington, but there's another, maybe some of the Portland ones could come over. I mean, they're not that far from us. And have these things where they can help people maybe write down all health. Somebody make a med list.
Mm-hmm.
Help them make the over-the-counters, whatever herbals they're taking. Maybe they can look that stuff up for them. If somebody shares, okay, I have a heart condition, or I'm on this or that, if they can take a gander at those meds, is that really the best for them? I mean, I'm blessed in the fact that I can look at people's labs and say, okay, they're not going to clear that drug that fast. This is a real concern for me. Or they've got a lot of meds that are going to affect their thinking. You're saying they have some dementia. Well, maybe you should take some of these meds off and let's see if that really clears them. So those are the kind of recommendations I make on a routine basis. So I'm not quite sure how that can be done, but maybe through volunteers. I mean, I've done community outreach with more on a charitable basis, with the free clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Southwest Free Clinic or some of the bigger events that they have. I would wonder if there's something, if you could ask for volunteers and see if maybe you could get some pharmacists, but it's going to take people bringing in their all their medications and all this, and like I said, over the counter supplements, because you need the whole picture. Again, the ideal is that somebody can go in the home.
Donna and then Amy.
Is it possible you can get too much vitamin D1?
You mean the over-the-counter product?
Mm-hmm.
That one's always, there's nobody really saying too much about it. As long as your kidneys are functioning fine, I've seen people upwards of 5,000 units. And some patients, especially in the Northwest, they're really recommending at least 2,000 to start. And when they've run those blood levels, nobody can agree what's the right level. I'll be honest. I mean, everybody has their own opinion, whether it's the Kidney Association or the Endocrine Association. I mean, nobody can come up, and that's the big controversy with that. So I'd say if you're probably going to do between 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000, you're probably going to be fine. But, you know, they can always look at a blood test. I've seen people working with endocrinologists, and they had a level of 80, and most of our guys, you can get it to 30. It's amazing.
So, Amy, was she a question?
That's fine. Thank you.
I appreciate what you're saying about needing to go into the home and see what's really there. Have there been any programs to use retired nurses or volunteer nurses' aides or someone to go in and teach them what to look for?
I don't know if there has been. I mean, that would be ideal. That would be the absolute best. And I don't know how patients, you know, if there was a program like that, that'd be wonderful. Patients could, I mean, people could sign up for it and recognize that people are going to come to their home. Because some people, they say they're willing to take that help, and then somebody shows up at their home, and they're not terribly pleased about it. So, you know, as long as they're cognizant and
Does the HIPAA Act extend to pharmaceuticals and prescriptions?
I can't discuss life-saving medications because I can look at a med list and pretty much tell you exactly what they're being treated for.
The reason for my question is if you're using volunteers to go to people's homes and help them with their prescriptions, how would HIPAA affect that kind of a program?
I don't know that HIPAA covers the home environment because people will hire caregivers, they will hire med aides, all these other people come in through these other agencies, family members. So I don't know that HIPAA is something that applies in the home, and if the person who's sitting in the home says, you can do this, they're giving you permission to work with their medications. I would think that would be a less of an issue, but that would be something that somebody would look at. But I honestly don't think it's a big player. But I would hope somebody would be confidential about what would go in there, especially if you're getting retired professionals who's been in that role. They aren't going to be discussing what that person had. That's just not something we do.
Christina, did you have a comment?
I just wanted to comment. So our agency does do home care visits, and so we don't typically have volunteers, but as a standard, anytime we have volunteers who are working in our programs, they're bound by the same confidentiality that we are expected to uphold. So I wonder if there would be a similar practice that if you had a volunteer program, they would be required to uphold the same standards that professional organization had.
And your agency is?
HIPAA training would be one that you would want to be looking at if there was, you know, confidentiality issues around medical information going on. So I wonder if that would be the standard that they would have.
Would you say the name of your agency that you are?
Your agency would be Disability Disabilities.
Are there any questions from the audience before we move to the next speaker? And we might take some now and some after both speakers, so. Okay, you're off the hook for now. Nancy Beth Truster will discuss how pain works, what makes pain better or worse, and most importantly, what you can do to decrease pain. She's been a physical therapist for 23 years, specializing in persistent pain, pelvic health, and aquatics, and has been teaching community classes on understanding pain for the past 3 years. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here to talk about pain. It's a subject that not everybody wants to talk about.
Make sure you write into the microphone there. Yeah.
Is that better?
Yeah, it's better.
So pain serves a really important purpose. It warns and protects us and keeps us safe from harm. It really gets our attention. And Marjorie really kind of alluded to what I'm going to be talking about, but I'm going to talk about what pain is, how it's produced, so you have a better understanding of it. You know, everybody has their personal experience with pain, but we don't, a lot of people don't really know some of the facts about how it works. We're going to talk a little bit about what is persistent or chronic pain. And you'll see that some of the things I'm talking about are going to be more, a little more toward that aspect, since that is, again, a big problem for people. I'm going to talk a little bit about what makes it better or worse, why some people have pain when others don't, and most importantly, what can you do to increase it. So chronic persistent pain is really complex. It's a complex subject, and it's difficult to figure out. Here are some things that you could think about, you yourself or someone you know have persistent pain. Have you ever noticed that your pain has spread from one body area to another, or that you can't really identify where your pain is, you can't locate it? Has your pain gotten worse when you're under stress? Do you avoid doing things because you're hurt, and therefore you just are inactive and don't do things? Have you ever felt pain from things that typically are not painful? Pressure, or touch, or heat or cold? And again, sort of the thing, my focus here is, have you stopped doing the things that you enjoy? Have you kind of stopped living your life the way you wanted to because of pain? Anyone who's in chronic pain or knows somebody, it can really take over your life and affect, you know, pretty much every aspect of it. So I want to talk for a moment about how pain is produced. Pain is produced by the brain 100% of the time for all people in all instances. No exceptions. And all pain is real pain. Oh, sorry, I just whipped through these, didn't I? Let's start that again.
We want to get rid of pain.
Oh, it's doing it on its very own. I'm not doing that. And I know of.
Help is on the way.
Okay. Okay, I don't know what's going on here. I'm going to give it to you, aren't you, clerk? So, that might have been a slightly shocking statement. Pain is produced in the brain. And what I mean by that is that pain is an output from the brain and nervous system out to the body part that's in pain. We used to think for hundreds of years that pain worked a certain way based on the French philosopher René Descartes' discoveries of how things work. You touch a fire, you get pain here, there's a nerve that transmits that information to your brain, and then your brain sends another signal down, and you quit taking your hand off the fire. We know that it's slightly different now. What happens is, when something, in this case like an ankle sprain occurs, there's going to be something that happens there. The ligaments are going to twist, you're going to feel off balance, you know, there's going to be various things that happen. And the way it works is that information is sent up to your brain as sort of, there's something going on down there. There's a threat, there's a danger to me. And then it is your brain and your nervous system that take that information, put it all together, and send that pain back down there. Now, of course, this is instantaneous, and you do have pain in your ankle. It's just that knowing that pain comes from the brain and nervous system also gives us the opportunity to work on other ways to decrease pain besides just addressing that area that hurts. I also want to say that all pain is real pain. It's another thing we focus on a lot. Sometimes when I say pain is in the brain, people are thinking, are you saying I'm making that up? Are you saying it's in my mind? No, it's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it is literally in your brain and your nervous system. And I'm going to explain a few more things as we go to maybe flesh that out a little bit for you. Since pain is this output, it's responding to, again, that signal that's coming in. So let's look at the ankle sprain again, for example. Those things happen to the ankle, information goes up to the brain. It's going to go to the relay center of the brain and then to all the different areas of the brain. the sensing part, the moving part, the thinking part, your memory, all kinds of different things. And this is why people sprain their ankles, since one person has a lot more pain than somebody else. Context also is going to make a difference. If I sprained my ankle and I sprained it the year before, and I lost my job, and my house went up for foreclosure, that person very well, that memory part, that's still going to weigh into the big picture, and that person might experience more pain. If I'm running into the street to get my child out from the front of a car, and I twist my ankle on the way, it is likely that that person will feel any pain, because the threat to their system, the threat to them, the danger to them, the most important thing is getting their child out of the road. So there's a lot of things that go along with context, and that makes it more complex. Okay. So this is just a little summary, again, of basically there's an input, there's processing through the brain, and then there's output. That said, what I'm saying is not in your mind. Our emotions and our thoughts, so those are brain impulses. So those still play a part in our pain. All pain is real. People aren't making up severe pain. Pain is an experience. Can we move to the next slide? You can kind of sum it up by this equation of when the system, your person, when you have more danger or threat, more than safety, that's when pain is going to be there. When safety is greater than a threat or danger, then there should be pain. So pain and harm are not the same thing. And I think this is a pretty important thing to talk about as well. You can have pain without harm, and you can have harm without pain. I talked a little bit, again, you might have harm without pain, that example of running, getting your child on the road. There are many examples of somebody who's in battle, and they've had an amputation of their arm, but they're pulling their friend out and saving them. Those people don't have pain because something else is going on. You can definitely have pain without harm. Kind of common examples are even like a headache. Nothing's broken or bleeding or torn. Diagnoses like fibromyalgia and things like that. There's definitely pain there, but there isn't a physical harmful thing that's happened. And I think the biggest one, again, is when people have an injury, they get pain, and that pain lasts for years and years and years. It's kind of realizing that in most cases, those things have healed, 3 to 6 months after an injury. But people have this ongoing pain even without harm. So this is an x-ray of two knees. The one on the left is showing severe degeneration of the knee, kind of bone on bone. And the one on the right is a normal knee. Any guess as to which person has more pain?
Yeah.
Your answer might have been different before you heard what I just said. You can move it to the next thing. So you certainly are going to probably think the person that has the bone-on-bone arthritis, but one particular study is showing half the people with severe arthritis in their knee that shows up on an x-ray do not have any pain at all. And 10% of people that have no arthritis, a perfectly normal knee, could have severe pain. There have been multiple studies over years where they take people kind of off the street and they that don't have pain. They do MRIs, they do x-rays, they do all kinds of imaging, and on those people they still find disc bulging, arthritis, stenosis. They still find these things going on, but those people don't necessarily have pain. So I think the idea is sort of that an x-ray or an MRI does not equal your pain. A really common response to pain is that people stop moving because it hurts and they don't want to hurt. And they feel that if they're active and if they're doing things that they might again be harming themselves. But just remember, at least from that aspect, pain and harm are not the same thing. It's really natural for our bodies to want to move. I really think our bodies sort of have a natural state of health that they want to be at, and they want to be moving. Move to the next one. So this is problems with not moving can not only affect making muscles more tight, weak, stiff, all those kind of things. But when you don't move, you actually can change your brain. So this slide here is showing that, kind of showing that we all have a map of our body that's in our brain. They can scan the brain and actually see what parts of the brain correspond with which body parts. And this is how we know. It's my right foot, that's my left hip, this is my back. It's how we identify the parts of our body. The map is based on movement and how much things are used. So you're going to see along the side there where they show like the face and the lips and the hands are much have much more representation in the brain than the trunk and the leg because they're used much more often. The really interesting thing about this is that we are bioplastic. There's a term used a lot now, neuroplasticity. Our brains themselves change all the time. You know, we used to think of the brain a little bit more like a computer. If something went wrong somewhere in the brain, then you're kind of out of luck. But we know that not only can things, you know, change in the long run, they can change in a very short time. There's an interesting research study where they took monkeys and are able to do a scan and kind of map out their body parts. And then they took these monkeys and they taped two of their fingers together and they let them go off and play. And just 20 minutes later, they took those monkeys back again and did another brain scan, another mapping of their body parts. And before they taped the fingers, there were two distinct digits on the map. And after 20 minutes, it had changed to one distinct digit and one finger. So, I mean, things change quickly. The good news about that is we can do things to really change situations that aren't the way we want them to be. So one of the hardest things I think the patients have to deal with and people have to deal with is how to get moving again and how to be active when you're having pain, especially when, again, it's long-term and chronic pain. People, again, they don't get moving and they may fall into what I just talked about, that inactive scenario, or probably more so the patients that I see overdo it. And they have to get things done, and they hurt, but they just overdo. They have to build a patio on Monday and all the bricks. You know, they just they have to do things. And so they kind of actually flare up things. So, and I also think this is kind of emotionally one of the harder parts for people with chronic pain. Nobody likes pain, it doesn't feel good. But I think one of the harder things that I see across the board is it's really difficult for people to deal with not being able to do what they used to do. And not be able to and grieve that and really have that be part of it. So if you go to the next slide. On this graph, on the left side, there's a representation showing how much activity a person can do before they would hit tissue damage. And this is someone who has basically a normal nervous system that's not oversensitized, that's not been giving up that pain signal for too long. And you can see you can do a lot of things before you're gonna get pain. And we wanna have pain. Pain's gonna tell us, don't keep doing that or you're gonna hurt yourself. If I keep that heating on any longer, I'm gonna burn. It's also a thing, so you're kind of watching that. So people can do a lot of activities and occasionally go into that pain or injury spot. On the right, we're comparing sort of a normal nervous system to what happens to somebody who has persistent pain where their nervous system is oversensitized. You can see that the tissue damage line is a little bit lower and might come on sooner than somebody else. And that's more or less about, again, deconditioning and muscles are too tight and their bodies might not just be in as great shape. But look where the pain response pain line is. It's way down there. Meaning the pain is going to come on, one big thing you get from this is that pain is going to come on way before you're actually again going to harm yourself. Which kind of brings us back to that. You know, people, they bend this far and they don't want to bend anymore because that hurts my back, so I never ever bend more than that. I see people like that all the time. Bending more than that, a little further down, it might hurt, it might cause some pain, but it's not going to cause damage. So what we want to do is we want to figure out how we can return our system a little more to a normalized nervous system. So we want to work on some pacing. Again, you don't want to not move, but you also don't want to keep flaring up. Because if you repeatedly flare, meaning if you do something and
You have to stay in bed in the next couple of days because you've overdone it so much. If you do that every now and then, I mean, that really isn't a problem. It's not harming you. But when people do that over and over, they flare, they recover, they flare, they recover, and they just continually do that, it affects the nervous system. Again, it affects the brain and nervous system, and it makes their nerves kind of oversensitive, which means it doesn't take that much to get that pain to start going. So what you want to do is figure out pacing. And again, I feel like this is one thing that is really tricky for people. Let's say that a person can walk for 10 minutes without a flare-up. So they can do a 10-minute walk. If they go more than that, they're going to be in bed the next day or it's going to cause them a problem. So I think what a lot of people tend to do is 10 minutes is so puny, so they just sit back down and they don't do anything. But what you want to do is you want to do that 10-minute walk, or you can take any activity you want and break it down. You want to do what you can do without the flare, so that your body starts moving again, that mass starts changing, and the muscles start strengthening. So you walk 10 minutes every day for a week or two, or every other day, or twice a day, whatever you can kind of do. And you might hurt while you're walking. You might have some pain during the walk. But again, what we're kind of looking at is that flare-up line. So let's say after a couple weeks, I'm doing pretty good. I can walk that 10 minutes, you know, getting a little easier maybe. I'm going to try to up it. Maybe I'm going to go to 11 minutes, or maybe I'm going to go to 15. I'm going to choose something else. So now I'm going to walk 15 minutes. And again, I might be a little more sore. That caused a little more pain, but you know, I'm not flared. I'm not in bed the next day. I'm not way overdoing it. And then you do that for a little bit. And then, you know, you just slowly keep upping that. So if you look at that line, I think you can move my slides along here. As you slowly start doing it, that's what's going to normalize. I think there's one more. That's what's going to normalize the pain response and, you know, that protection that pain gives us. And again, I think that it's very challenging for people because it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance. And again, you have to do like small things that, again, seem like they're not enough. Sometimes I give my patients 3 repetitions of an exercise. Okay. Goofy, but that's sometimes really where you need to start. Okay, so you can move along there. So this is just a reminder that stress is coupled with pain. This is, so I do teach a class over at Providence, and it is a class for the community. It's a 2-hour class that talks about a lot of what I'm talking about, but a lot more sort of fleshed out. In that class, we do some different guided imagery, and we do some different things about working on stress and sort of a lot more about that. I really believe that our planet is pretty stressed out. And I would have said that 10 years ago. It seems like it's worse. Everybody has so many stresses, and everybody needs to deal with this. But when you have pain and you have stress, it is going to increase your pain. So you get pain. Pain itself is stressful, and then just add in other life stresses. You're going to get that fight or flight pain response or stress response. Blood pressure and heart rate are going to go up. Muscles are going to get tight, which can be problematic for pain. You're not digesting well. A lot of people in chronic pain have digestive issues. So you're kind of get stuck in that cycle of fight or flight. And what this slide is showing up here is that chemicals are released when you get stressed. So adrenaline, cortisol are released when the body goes into that fight or flight, and those can actually increase your pain. I've never heard anyone say when they were stressed they felt their pain was less. So what we want to do about that, of course, is work on stress management, work on quieting and relaxing and calming down the nervous system, calming down the body, and therefore decreasing your pain. We're going to skip that. Let's keep going. So now what I want to do is kind of move away from talking so much about just the danger problems and focus a little bit more again on the things that people do to make them happy, make them feel safe, loving and being loved, connection with other people, along with being healthy, you know, eating good food, getting good sleep, moving in the right way. One of the things I often tell my patients is the things that a person with persistent pain needs to work on to help them are the same things we everyone should do. It's kind of about extreme self-care. You know, it's like everybody needs to have those things, good sleep, good food, be active but not too active, manage your stress. But if you've got pain going on, those kind of things are really going to exacerbate that pain and make things a lot worse.
So there's going to be some clicking as we're talking here. So let's talk about, again, this is just a little review of what I talked about. Understanding pain, why we teach this class and why we think this is so important. There is research that shows that just learning about pain decreases your pain. It's actually a very interesting study where they took people with back pain and did a forward bending test, did a functional MRI, which is an MRI where they're just contracting, they were just doing something in the MRI and it was just contracting their abdominals. They can do a brain scan, they look at the slices of the scan and they can see where pain is being generated in the brain. They took those people, took them to a little class and just taught them about how pain works and taught them different things. They went back in the MRI, they did it again, and the amount of areas of the brain where pain was being produced was much less. With no other intervention, just learning that. So we know that that's really important. So, and again, just a little reminder, a couple things. You want to think of your arthritis maybe more as kisses of time, instead of people come in and like, my doctor told me my arch is collapsing and my spine is degenerating and all these horrible things are happening. And that's going to, again, just kind of plug into more of that danger message going on. So also just knowing that those things are, naturally, we all get a little bit of arthritis, and that can be okay. I don't have to have symptoms because of that. Quieting your stress, again, moving. We kind of like to use this phrase, sore but safe, not overdoing it. And again, just doing the things that you love to do in life. I think some people also wait to get together with friends or supportive people until they feel better. Well, I'll call that person for lunch when I'm not in so much pain. But the truth is, getting together with people that support you and love you will help your pain. You know, people also have experience about, I went out with some people I hadn't seen in a while, we had lunch, and I didn't even notice my pain the whole time. I mean, that's not just a, random thing. I think we all know that that happens, but there is a real reason why that happens. A little talk about medication. Many people are really focused on their medication and thinking that medication is the only thing that can help their pain. What we know is that there are problems with, especially opioid use and limits. Pain medication is the most effective in an acute situation, right after surgery, right after an injury, when it can be helpful. When you have pain for years and you have that long-term pain, pain medication often is even not that helpful. You can just kind of flip through those. There really isn't evidence of long-term pain relief, again, for people with chronic pain. The pain medication can make other things worse. Constipation, which you'll well know if you're around pain medications, decreasing your energy, sexual dysfunction. And there are instances where the actual pain medications themselves increase your pain. So I think our main point with this, in a way though, is there are so many other things you can do, all the things that I'm talking about, that are much better at getting at the root of what the problem is, the medication. And it's not to say that it doesn't play a role in things. But again, a lot of people are very, they just feel that nothing else will help them with that. And part of what I like, why I like teaching this, is educating and letting people know there's a lot of other things actually that you can do. The way I see people get better, honestly, I think is from a little bit from different things. They start moving, maybe it's 5% less pain. They start, sleeping better because they're exercising. Maybe that drops their pain a little. They start working on their stress. They do all these various things, and I think one tiny thing alone maybe won't make as much difference, but these things really add up. People really can get better and decrease their pain. We're not always saying that we can tell someone with chronic pain that your pain would be completely gone, although I would never tell someone you always have pain, which I know doctors hear frequently tell people, kind of warning you like your pain might be around, but at least we want to help people turn the volume down on their pain. At least get it to where it's the most minimal.
Okay, the next few slides are kind of part of the end of the class that I teach, just talking about, well, what can people do? Again, extreme self-care is sort of my answer, but, you know, find ways to move, do a gentle yoga class, you know, do relaxation or meditation. There are so many things out there like right now that can help you. Get back to your hobbies, do things that are fun. Don't focus on your pain all the time. If you focus on pain, you think about it all the time, you talk to everyone about it, you only pay attention to your right leg, you never even pay attention to the rest of your body, that is going to put your brain's focus on pain, and that is going to make that worse. Counseling is listed up there just because, you know, living with pain is rough, and sometimes people benefit from that. We do have a persistent pain program at Providence that we are pretty proud of because all our therapists, including and all our physicians at Providence, are trained in a lot of this new information about pain. And just to let you know, people do come to physical therapy. When you have persistent pain and you're in physical therapy, we want to be treating you differently than if you didn't. A lot of people that have pain have gone to therapy in the past, and they got on a bike, and they were told to do a whole bunch of exercises, and they flared so bad that they never went back to therapy ever again. Because really that therapist wasn't looking at the big picture and determining what was going on with them. So we do a lot of pain education, more specifics about relaxation, quieting the body, retraining body sensing, helping that person kind of pace and get back to activity. That's a little flyer about our class. Another thing that I actually put back there, there's Providence website, myprovidence.org. It's not like Providence, my chart. You don't have to be associated with Providence in any way to go on My Providence. But if you go on there, you can kind of click in as a guest, and we have a number of videos on there about more educational things about pain. We have some guided sort of relaxation, body sensing, things that you can listen to. And you know, I think we really just want to get the word out to pretty much the whole world. The pain is not what we've always thought is there are a lot of things that you can do. And it's pretty exciting work. That's it. And then, you know, I guess just a reminder too that this is complex. It's not real straightforward for a lot of people. And so just to be kind of patient and be kind to yourself is probably the biggest message. So that's all I have.
Okay. So, questions from the commission? Don?
Thank you for that. Yeah. I really appreciated your pointing out the positive aspects of trying to manage pain rather than just focusing on it, but doing all these other things. I unfortunately had two friends who had a tube with the morphine, you know, distribution. What percentage of people actually had that?
Are you talking about something that was implanted for them?
Yes.
Is it a neurostimulator?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and it's true, I really focused today's talk a lot on what you can do for your pain, and this is really important. This doesn't put aside that some people need surgery. Some people need cortisone shots. Some people need that. Usually, though, if somebody does need another sort of medical intervention like that, these kind of things will go along with that, again, to kind of help turn that volume down on the pain. I don't know about percentage. Sometimes it's also, though, people get in situations with surgery or pain-type things when they haven't tried this stuff. So our advice, too, really, of course, we're physical therapists, so we didn't really have anything to do directly with medication or surgery, but we'd always be for trying other things, of course, first, and getting second opinions. And remember that for surgery, that does not necessarily, the arthritis or something being out of alignment or, you know, something, that does not necessarily equal pain. There are many people that have surgery and then they still have their pain. Mm-hmm. I mean, and surgery sometimes is very, very helpful and can definitely be the right thing, so I definitely don't want to say that. I think it's just being aware of again, just all the different.
Temple?
the question I have, so for folks who are family members or caregivers or friends of somebody in the patient position who is dealing with chronic pain, are there classes like this or programs for those folks to help? I've seen a lot of people living with chronic pain who have become consumed by it and maybe aren't in a place where they'd say, I'm going to go take this class.
Right. So first of all, the class that we just teach, certainly people bring their spouses and friends, you can bring anyone to the class as well. I think for caregivers, it's really important, one, to... It's tricky business. You want to also acknowledge and believe someone when they say they have pain. For people that have chronic pain, they look fine. They don't have a bandage around their head, they're not bleeding, they look fine usually. You look okay. Why can't you do this, this, and this? And again, it's kind of that little bit of feeling like maybe pain isn't as bad as it is. How could it be this long? How could it be this high intensity? How could it be this real? But it can. That said, when somebody kind of gets into that and again just kind of wallows in it and focuses on it too much, I'm sure it can be helpful for family members to, again, learn the same information to just kind of maybe help guide them towards some of those other things. It's part from my viewpoint with physical therapy, we certainly would encourage people coming in and learning as well. And a lot of times spouse or people close to them really need to know and get educated on what's going on.
Allie?
Yeah, and just so I heard you correctly, I'm a nurse and I treat patients with pain a lot, but your emphasis in this presentation is that one method is usually not effective in treating chronic pain.
Well,
a combination.
I think because it's so complex, and it's not to say that one thing couldn't take care of that. And when we see people for this, we still want to look at, I also don't want to make it that we're not looking at their joints and their tissue and strength and stability and flexibility. We are looking at all those traditional things that might help with pain. But for the most part, because this is stuff that people don't think about and don't look at, we feel that that's added to that. So it depends. I mean, if there is really something going on where that person needed a stabilization surgery and that really helped them a lot and they were able to figure that out with their doctor, certainly people can get a lot. I think what people have to do is kind of do some self-exploring and dig around a little bit to see what are the things that I am doing that might make my pain worse, and have to kind of be willing to look at that. Some of the big researchers in this, Laura Mosey and David Butler, have a book called Explaining Pain. Here are some of the early researchers on this information. They have a book out also called Protectometer, which is a little guidebook for people to look through and kind of try to find those places that they don't maybe realize might affect their pain. Because it is kind of tricky. Does that answer?
Yeah, thank you.
So in your classes, those 3 years where the classes are about understanding pain, who comes to those classes?
Anybody can really come to them. People are either sent usually by their physicians or through our physical therapy departments. So if someone's treating a patient, that they're working with some chronic pain, but they think that patient needs more education, they'll send them. So this is the community that's coming to these classes.
Do you get people that come in with their arms folded, like, I'm in pain, I'm here because I'm forced to be here, and do they get help?
Yeah, well, most classes I think people do pretty well. Occasionally there's somebody in there that just will kind of stubbornly, well, that's okay for everybody else, but for me, I need this. And I think this whole approach is you have to be ready to make changes. This is a self-driven way of treating pain. And you have to be willing to kind of look at some things and make some changes. And sometimes there are patients that come in that are really not ready, and they are unwilling to look at anything and do anything.
Amy, you had a question?
In your experience, is there one kind of pain or one syndrome or one symptom that makes somebody say, I can't move alone anymore, or I can't live my home anymore?
That, I mean, do you mean a specific body part or type, just whatever? I don't know if I've really seen that specifically. The thing about pain and the nervous system driving everything is pain is involved, but again, so is the immune system, and so is, again, the digestive system, and so is so many other factors that go with it, that I think when people are deciding to live in their home or not, I think that's a pretty complex decision that probably has to do with what caregivers they have, as well as, you know, what their needs are with that.
Are there any of the, you in the audience that have questions? I think you must have covered it.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So much. So in July, the Commission on Aging has a self-retreat, and that'll be posted time and place. But the next time we gather here, we'll be discussing elder justice, and we will have a representative, Mike Day, from the, help me.
From the Sheriff's Office.
So we look forward to seeing you here in August. Thank you so much. We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.